Behold, a gateway to your own past, if you wish.
History is strange, it's alien, and it won't give us what we would like to have.
After all the weeks of parties and discussions and meetings during the mornings and concerns about what was actually about to take place in the nation's largest city of Philadelphia, the convention was finally underway. And in its opening session, the governor of the state of Virginia, who more than any state was really responsible for calling and getting the convention organized, even though it was taking place in Pennsylvania, the governor of the state of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, stood before the convention, not the committee, the convention, and began to outline why they were there and what he thought, as representative of the state of Virginia, needed to happen. He began by outlining many of the problems with the Confederacy, and we've talked about some of those at great length, the facts that they were unable to defend themselves, that the government had no power, that there was grave danger facing the nation all around, and specifically that the Confederacy had, as he put it, and we talked about last week, too much democracy that was unable then to save justice. It was unable to preserve the rights that the individuals had believed that they had fought for during the Revolutionary War. Edmund Randolph then proceeded to introduce into the record 15 very short resolutions. This is what he said we ought to be doing. His number one resolution, and I'm not going to read all these to you because they're pretty much contained in the Virginia plan that we're going to talk about today, but you need to understand, you need to put yourself in the mind of one of the representatives at the Constitutional Convention. You've come here for the purpose of, as far as your state is aware, modifying and amending the Articles of Confederation, which clearly are not working to everybody's advantage. If you're a big state representative, you're tired of the small states interfering with good government. And if you're a small state representative, you're horrified at the idea that the big states might just run roughshod over what's best for you. If you're a medium-sized state, you're caught in the middle and you're not sure which is best. But in any case, you've come through the American Revolution. The ideals of the Declaration of Independence are ringing in your heart and in your mind. And as you've sat down here, you've heard the rumors that have just been flying through Philadelphia for the past few weeks about how Virginia, at least, is going to propose something radical, something new, something perhaps even bizarre. And if you're Gouverneur Morris, you're going to be very upset at first, although later you will come to support it. If you're George Mason, one of the Virginians, you like the idea in principle, but you don't think it goes far enough. And if you're John Reed of Delaware, you've sent letters off, George Reed of Delaware, you've sent letters off to John Dickinson, your fellow delegate, warning him that he needs to get there as quickly as possible before these large states just run roughshod over the small states like Delaware. As Edmund Randolph stands, he begins to speak. His first resolution reads as follows. And again, these are not long. One of the things I appreciate about politicians of the 1780s is their brevity and their ability to actually get to a point without having to tell me a story. Resolution number one, as introduced by Edmund Randolph, one, resolved that the Articles of Confederation ought to be so corrected and enlarged as to accomplish the objectives proposed by their institution, namely, quote, common defense, security of liberty, and general welfare, unquote. At this point, nobody has any disagreement at all. This is why, in fact, we are here. We need to amend. We need to change. We need to adjust. We need to fix. We need to figure out what's wrong with the Articles of Confederation so that we can provide for the common defense, the security of liberty, and the general welfare. You already see, we are literally seconds into the official convention, as it were. And you already see the genesis of ideas that will eventually find their way into what will be the Constitution downstream. It's fascinating to me that these men came here prepared. Nowadays, if you go to a convention of this sort, and there's a lot of people who are calling for an Article 5 convention, and I don't want to get too far off boat here, but do you think that today an Article 5 convention of, say, somewhere between 3 and 5 delegates from each state would take the time to prepare as thoroughly as these men did in 1787? And we're going to see, we already know, but we're going to see a little bit later about Madison and his preparations in his studies, simply to look at every form of government that mankind has ever instituted and see its advantages, its disadvantages. Where can we strengthen this? What can we do to perhaps make that work where others have failed? The preparation that goes into this is manifest, even from the very beginning. They already know what they are trying to do, which is provide for the common defense, which the Confederacy is not able to do, secure the liberties, which again, the Confederacy has not been able to do. We've seen this in Massachusetts with Jay's Rebellion. We've seen it in other places, and provide for the general welfare. And this, of course, is a swipe at, it's perceived as a swipe by the small states at specifically Rhode Island, who is not here. The nation has been unable to provide for general welfare, which is not, doesn't have quite the meaning that it has today. We tend to think of welfare today as subsistence from the government. In the 1780s, general welfare meant for the betterment of the nation, projects that benefited the entire nation. For example, a great example in my mind of general welfare has always been the interstate system. The interstate system is a marvelous transportation network that is unrivaled in the world. I mean, the Autobahn might be the closest thing to it, but the Autobahn is in a very relatively small country and doesn't really extend all that far. When you look at our interstate system or our railway systems, you see great examples of general welfare. Now, the railway system is somewhat different in that most of it was built privately, but some of that was built publicly, particularly the transcontinental sections. So you can see that there are ideas here that benefit the entire nation. We can move goods and people around this country very quickly. But under the Articles of Confederation, these sorts of things were impossible. In fact, one of the projects that Rhode Island stopped was a post road that would have allowed quicker transportation of mail and contact and communication through the Northeast, because Rhode Island wanted to put a tax on it, a tariff on it. And they said no. Doesn't do much good to build a road that ends at the Rhode Island border and then picks up on the other side. It's kind of a silly thing to do. The small states perceive that as something of a swipe to them. And literally minutes into the convention here, we're already starting to grate just a little bit, because general welfare is going to mean that the small states are going to have to give up some of their power, presumably, to the larger states, who, again, the smaller states are already terrified are just going to subsume them either by absorption or bankruptcy. They're just going to drive them under. The Virginians, I don't think, intended that to be the case. I don't believe that the Virginians, with their Madison plan, which will become the Virginia plan, ever thought to themselves, how can we get rid of Delaware and Rhode Island and maybe New Jersey? I don't think they ever thought that. But the larger states, particularly New York, Virginia, Massachusetts, the most populous states, were just absolutely tired of the smaller population states, the smaller states, not necessarily in size, but in population, essentially stopping things left and right. They were tired of the fact that there was no united in the United States of America. In fact, it had just literally become the states of America. There was no union to speak of, and they were tired of that. If we were going, once upon a time, a Pennsylvanian said, "Hey, we either hang together or we hang separately." And now it was Virginia reminding the rest of the convention of that very idea. Maybe Britain's not going to hang us for treason, but if we don't get this straightened out, this nation's not going to last. And so that first resolution says we're going to resolve that the Articles of Confederation ought to be so corrected and enlarged as to accomplish these objections, these objects proposed by their institution. Now, while they might disagree at this point with the methodology, no one in the room disagrees that this needs to happen. There's concerns about how this is going to happen, and that firestorm, of course, is going to be set off in the next few minutes as Governor Randolph continues to read. He resolves, therefore, that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned to the quotas of contribution or to the number of free inhabitants, as the one or the other rule may seem best in different cases. Well, we're starting to... We really haven't said anything new here. Remember, the Articles of Confederation already does this and already counts slaves as three-fifths of a person. Then he gets to number three. Resolve that the national legislature ought to consist of two branches. Up until this point, the legislature, the Congress, has been a single house, single legislative body, completely powerless, and selected by essentially the legislatures of the individual states. Number four, resolved that the members of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states every, and he uses the term blank, years, for the term of blank, to be the age of blank years, to receive liberal stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, to be ineligible for any other office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States, except those particularly belonging to the functions of the first branch, during the term of service and for the space of blank years after its expiration, to be incapable of re-election for the space of blank years after the expiration of their term of service, and to be subject to recall. Well, this has set the cats amongst the pigeons, because this is not a re-fixing. This is not an amendment. This is not a change. This is not fixing the Articles of Confederation. This, by the time we get to number four, is proposing an entirely new system of government. And in fact, Gouverneur Morris will stand up later when we move out of the convention and into the committee, which is, again, the same people sitting in the same place, except that George Washington steps down from the presidential dais. Gouverneur Morris will later say that this is nothing more than an attempt to eliminate the states entirely, not big states, not small states. This is a plan to eliminate all of the states. And as Governor Randolph reads through the rest of his resolutions, you begin to see the outline of the idea that the Virginians have come here with. This idea that the legislature needs to be two-parted, it needs to be responsive to the people of the United States in order to function as their overall federal centralized government, and it needs to have an element of not squashing the states. Although, oddly enough, the Virginians are not very good at expressing that idea. The cat will be amongst the pigeons. And as Governor Randolph finishes his speech and sits down, there's a good deal of silence because the convention doesn't necessarily want to get into this debate yet. And so the convention is tabled. General Washington steps down. And the Committee of the Whole is called into session. The Committee of the Whole is the same people doing the same thing in the same place. But now they're a committee, not a convention. What they do in the committee is talk, resolve, argue, debate, and propose to the convention various ideas to be voted upon. Who's in charge of the convention or the committee, you might be asking? Well, it's none other than the 14th President of the United States himself. He climbs to the dais and begins to oversee the Committee of the Whole. And who was that 14th President, you might be asking? I'll tell you in just a minute. It's Constitution Thursday on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show. In all of my studies of the Constitution and the framing and the founding of this nation, I think the one thing that I have taken away from this that just absolutely enthralls me is the imperfection of our founding fathers and our framing fathers. We tend to put these men on pedestals, especially guys like George Washington, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin. We put them on these pedestals of almost perfection. And it's almost nikol-terny, which is a Russian phrase, which means uncultured, transliterates as uncultured, but it means much more deeply than that. It's almost nikol-terny to bring up the flaws of some of these men. For example, George Washington. We don't like to talk about the fact that George Washington, in his early days, was a horrible leader militarily. I mean, this guy lost battles badly, and I don't mean during the Revolutionary War. I mean during the French and Indian War. He liked to cuss. I mean, I like to cuss. I think George Washington and I would probably get along for that reason, but James Madison was very uneasy with the fact that President Washington, as he eventually will become General Washington, as his language tended to be a little coarse. For a man who was so driven by protocol and proper behavior in public, he had a mouth on him when he was mad. But of course, there are so many other men involved with this that we're not as familiar with along the way. One of those men was the 14th President of the United States. Now, I know that's strange to say, but keep in mind that under the Articles of Confederation, a president was elected of the Congress who was designated as the President of the United States. These men have, in many ways, been lost mostly to history. And in fact, it's the 14th one who will become the president of the committee as a whole. He's well thought of. He's a merchant. He's relatively wealthy, and he's relatively successful. And his service after John Hancock had resigned as President of the United States, this is kind of a weird thing, and maybe we'll get into this again when we talk someday about the 22nd Amendment again. The original President of the United States under the Articles of Confederation, there was no really expiration date on their term. They either resigned or they died. And John Hancock resigned, and so Nathaniel Gorham had been elected in his place, serving 5 months as the 14th President of the United States. Now, because of the respect that men have for him, he is actually put in charge of the convention or the committee of a whole to oversee the debates, the discussions, all the actual work that will be done in the Philadelphia Convention. Nathaniel Gorham was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He was the son of Captain Nathaniel Gorham and Mary Sully. He was a descendant of John Howland, and was one of the pilgrims who had traveled to England from North America on the Mayflower. You can see that this guy had a good pedigree. But again, we put some people up on pedestals and other people we don't. We don't like to talk about their flaws. We don't like to talk about their weaknesses. Nathaniel Gorham's weakness will be shown later on in that while he is politically connected, he marries a daughter of a vicar who's quite powerful in the church. He conducts his apprenticeship starting when he's 15. He takes part in public affairs. He's very active during the American Revolution, although there's a part of me that wonders about some of this. He takes part in the public affairs. He's a member of the Massachusetts General Court, which is their legislature, from 1771 until 1775. He's a delegate to the Provincial Congress. He's a member of the Board of War from 1778 until its dissolution in 1781. In 1779, he serves in the state constitutional convention. He's a delegate to the Continental Congress, and again, he's the president at one point of all this. He also serves a term as a judge, Middlesex County and Massachusetts Court of Common Pleas. As you can see, he's a well-connected, well-involved man. He's somebody who is well-trusted and well-thought of as he takes that seat as president of the Committee of the Whole. He, in his service of that, he frequently serves as this chairman. He provides over these convention sessions during the delegates' first deliberations on the structure of the new government. And after the convention, he will work very hard to make sure that the Constitution is ratified in his home state of Massachusetts. And if the story of Nathaniel Gorham ended there, you would see his picture probably, I don't know, on at least a postage stamp, if not a coin somewhere. Nathaniel Gorham's contributions to the nation as a whole certainly cannot be underestimated. This is a man who dedicated a significant portion of his life both to independence and later to the Constitution. It's later on in life that Nathaniel Gorham becomes, I don't want to say problematic, but let's call him normal. He, again, we tend to put these guys up on pedestals, and perhaps rightfully so in some cases, but I think it's in the lessons of the men who aren't perfect, who aren't, I don't know, heroic generals or writers or whatever, that perhaps the bigger lesson is found. Nathaniel Gorham, who will oversee the Committee of the Whole, who will push for ratification, who fought in his own way, in his own service for independence, will benefit mightily from the establishment of a stable government. And he will seek to expand his financial empire to the West as he buys from Massachusetts a great deal of land that he plans to develop. He signs a contract with the government of Massachusetts. He gives almost $1 million in that day's money. Today's money, it's somewhere around $14 million for a huge tract of land, which he has great plans for, along with his partner, Oliver Phelps. The plans never materialize. Nothing goes right in this whole scheme, I guess, of flipping houses, almost the 1790s equivalent of flipping houses. And eventually Nathaniel Gorham and his partner Oliver Phelps are forced to declare bankruptcy, and they actually have to give the land back to the state of Massachusetts, which of course was hoping that he would do something with it, because as it turns out, Native Americans are living on this and they don't really have a plan for what they're going to do with this land. And they were hoping that Gorham and Phelps could take care of that little problem for them, as it were. But now they're going to have to deal with it. And this doesn't set well with people. This is a giant failure. And eventually, in some form or another of disappointment, and I guess you would call it failure, Nathaniel Gorham finally dies in 1796. His eulogy is delivered by Dr. Thomas Welch of Charlestown, and he's buried in the Phillips Street Cemetery in Charlestown, Massachusetts. The story after that, of course, is in some ways just as interesting. The list of his descendants is legion. It includes Gorham Parks, who was a U.S. representative from Maine and a candidate for governor in Maine. Charlotte Gray Brooks, the wife of Edward Everett, American politician and educator from Massachusetts. His descendants take up almost two pages of his biography, and you read all of this and you realize that the measure of a man isn't always in what he does in lifetime. Sometimes it's in what happens after he's gone. And Nathaniel Gorham is one of those men who, if you were to walk down the street today and say, "Do you know who Nathaniel Gorham was? You would probably get blank stares from 999 out of 1,000 people. One or two people might say, "Yeah, I've heard that name somewhere. Isn't he the guy that's dating, you know, one of the Kardashian sisters or something? Didn't he write some songs? Doesn't he sing with, you know, the Beatles or whatever?" But no, the truth of the matter is very few people will actually know who this guy is and the influence that he's going to have. He's going to oversee the Committee of the Whole as they pick apart, discuss, argue, debate the Virginia plan as presented by Edmund Randolph. And believe me, while the convention headed by George Washington, presided over by George Washington, might be stately, and in fact, at one point, there will be great complaints about the fact that nobody seems to want to talk at all during the convention. Somebody will make a proposal and no one wants to discuss it, debate it, argue about it, and even the newspapers, in one of the rare occasions when they get something right, will pick up on the fact that there's virtually no discussion during the convention sessions. It's almost as if people are afraid to speak their mind, and they are, because the convention is tasked with fixing the Articles of Confederation, but that's not what they're talking about, is it? They're talking about replacing the Articles of Confederation, and nobody's sure if they can do that or not, officially. So it's during these Committee of the Whole sessions that the discussions will be lively, pointed, and perhaps spirited, I guess would be a good way to describe them. They never really become what I would call frank, bordering on direct. They never become mean. They never become anything like that. Something that I doubt seriously we could ever achieve today. Well, anytime somebody says to me, Dave, you need to support an Article 5 convention, I start asking pointed questions of that kind of nature. And it's odd to me that very few people who are in favor of an Article 5 convention have ever thought through the original convention and what it meant and what it did and how it operated. And almost no one can guarantee, and I can guarantee that it wouldn't, function in the same way. These men now hear the Virginia plan, which we're going to round out here in just a moment, tell you the rest of the plan. There are deep concerns. The primary concern, though, could be laid, the primary concerns, I guess, there are really two concerns here. Number one concern is, we know we got to do something, but can we do this? Are we, in fact, authorized to do something that seems far beyond fixing, amending the Articles of Confederation? That's not what's being proposed here by Virginia. Again, we're literally minutes into the convention, and we've already proposed something that is totally the opposite of why we believe we're here, why the entire nation believes we're here. The second concern, of course, is the relationship between the states and the federal government. The small states, as I said, are horrified that the big states are just trying to run them roughshod. The big states are concerned with the Virginia plan because it appears, at least on the surface of things, that what we're doing is simply abolishing states and replacing that with a national government. Now, there are some reasonable arguments for doing that. If you were to argue that today, I think you would look at today's United States and you'd kind of go, well, pretty much have already anyway. But in 1787, this was unthinkable because the states were presumed to be sovereign and the states were presumed to be absolute. They were united, but they were not one. In fact, it's kind of interesting language when you look at the way the United States is described in history. The verbiage changes later on. But at this point, it's the United States, and they're referred to in the plural, the United States are. Later on, after the Civil War, when the supremacy of the federal government becomes complete, it will be said the United States is, and that's how we refer to it today. But prior to that, they're referred to always in the plural. Shelby Foote, the great author of the Civil War books, has pointed this out on numerous occasions. At this point, this is a union of states, sovereign individual states, and they are not ready to give that up yet. It's Constitution Thursday on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show. We'll be right back. it's easy for us to take for granted the government that we have today, its alignment that we have. We're well familiar with our three branches of government, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial, which, if you'll permit me my pet peeve, are not and never were intended to be co-equal in power and glory. And so we seem to forget, and we just sort of take for granted that it wasn't always that way. Under the Confederacy, there was just a single Congress that was appointed by the states. And when this Virginia plan would be introduced, it would have inklings of what we would eventually end up with, but very rudimentary in their functionality. So what do we have here? What we have are the 13 states, the people of the 13 states, electing what is called the first branch of government. It's an interesting title. I would imagine that they spent a good deal of time trying to figure out what to call each part of this. But the first branch of the government, which they want to have term limits on, but they don't know what those term limits should be. They don't know how long the term of office should be, nor do they know how old you should have to be at this point to be in that. These are things that the plan leaves open as presented by Governor Randolph. The people elect this first branch. The first branch then appoints, elects, however you want to put it, the second branch. And between these two branches is the shared power to propose taxes, propose population shifts, any of that sort of thing that's going to go into this thing. And it's called the National Legislature. It's the second branch then that interfaces with the state governments. The state governments can be vetoed by the second branch. In other words, if the state legislature passes a law that the national government doesn't like, it's the second branch that can veto the state law. Likewise, the 13 state legislatures can have input into that second branch, although it's unclear initially what exactly that input into there is. It's the second branch, then, that elects the national executive. Now, again, there's still some debate at this point as to whether that's one person. Is it a committee? Is it a group? Is it a board? We don't know yet, nor do the Virginians really have that fleshed out. They do know that it's limited to a single term. You can be the national executive once, and then you're done. And, of course, they then appoint the inferior courts that will eventually serve as the nation's judicial system. The national executive also is served by what's known as a council of revision, which then appoints the superior courts, the supreme tribunals, if you will, which then answer to what will be known as an appeal of last resort, a court of appeal of last resort, which is roughly analogous to the Supreme Court ultimately, which is then chosen by the inferior courts, not the middle courts. So it's kind of a confusing mess here, but the Council of Revision is what has the veto power over the national legislature, not the national executive. The Council of Revision can also veto state laws which interfere with the government of the United States. And this is where we really see the birth of the idea of federal supremacy, because states are passing laws that create, of course, havoc for the federal government. And there's no guarantee that a revision of the Articles of Confederation, amendments, fixing, whatever you want to call it, will in any way, shape, or form trade that. So the biggest, there's a lot of stuff here in this Virginia plan that is intriguing. There's some ideas here that aren't here that are problematic, and we're going to get into those in just a second. But I think the biggest intriguing idea to me here is the fact that the federal government now has authority over the state governments. As I said, Gouverneur Morris will object to this, saying you're essentially dissolving the state governments. You're doing away with states. For all practical purposes, there will be no purpose for them because, again, the people of the states will elect their legislatures, their state legislatures, and the first branch, which then turns around and elects the second branch and the national executive and the Council of Revision. So where is the role here, as it were, for a state government, is Morris's argument. There is some validity to that argument under this particular model. And, of course, it is this point where we start to see the idea here that the federal government is going to have power over the states. If there's any one gigantic flaw in the Confederacy, it's that the federal government cannot compel the states to do anything, whether it's a tax, whether it's provide troops, whether it's a national policy on tariffs. The national government has no power. But as you can begin to see here under the Virginia Plan, that's the one thing that it really does, is it puts the national government superior to the state government, with the power to veto any state law that it feels encroaches upon its authority. Well, obviously the states aren't going to like that kind of language, and we'll see downstream. There are some other problems here. In the Virginia Plan, there is no list of enumerated powers. In other words, there's no discussion here of what can the government do, what can't it do. There's just some general outlines of how it would function in the sense of a flow chart, but as far as what the government can actually do, what we will later know as Article 1, Section 8, the enumerated powers of government, doesn't exist here. Furthermore, there's no limits on the power of government, and that's got some people just a little bit nervous too. I mean, if you're essentially doing away with the sovereignty of the states, which is what the argument will be here, and you are, as they accused Ronald Reagan of doing once, just going over the heads of Congress and the media straight to the people, then how are you going to, why would you even need a state government at that point? Some of us may be asking that question today anyway, but the truth of the matter is that this proposal is intriguing in a lot of ways, because you begin, like I said, to see the genesis of some of the ideas, but you also see many of the problems that had to be overcome. The concept of checks and balances is here in that legislative acts could be vetoed by the council, comprised of the executive and selected members of the judicial branch. That's your council of revision. So you have kind of a Supreme Court, kind of the concept here of judicial review embedded in the Virginia Plan. That's interesting because, of course, as we will get on later into things, the idea of judicial review is controversial, and yet if you really look at what the convention does, it's almost kind of understood that it's there. That's its whole purpose in some ways. The Virginia Plan does not make it eventually. It's going to be rejected as a whole. It will be rejected as a whole because of some of these flaws that we're talking about. But it's these flaws also that will cause discussions to be held in the Committee of the Whole, overseen by Nathaniel Gorham, that will then begin to work out some of these difficulties with the Virginia Plan. They will smooth some edges, as it were. And, of course, they'll do this by looking at other plans as well. Some of the other plans that will be submitted are the New Jersey Plan and the Pinckney Plan. We're going to talk a little bit more about those here in just a second, but these are alternate plans presented by smaller states and slave states as to how this government should be formed. Ultimately, the Connecticut Compromise will be proposed, and many of the people involved with that, including John Dickinson of Delaware, will begin to see the wisdom of having these three branches, as it were, and splitting that first branch into two. But they're not quite satisfied with the way Virginia has come up with this. Virginia, keep in mind, is a large state, and it is very frustrated with the small states and their reticence to do things correctly or for the general welfare. And so they are very much against the one state, one vote idea. And that's one of the reasons why they've proposed this national legislature be selected on the basis of popular election by the states and proportionally sized. That, of course, will be what ends up in the House of Representatives, but not in the state Senate, which will represent the states. The New Jersey plan will propose a single chamber legislation in which each state, regardless of size, would have one vote. This, of course, an anathema to Virginia. They don't like that at all. The Pinckney plan is somewhat more problematic. And for the most part, it's a expansion, more elaborate form of the Virginia plan. The problem with the Pinckney plan presented by Charles Pinckney, who's the governor of South Carolina, the problem with the Pinckney plan is that it's questionable as to whether or not this is what he actually presented at the convention. Madison didn't take a lot of notes about what Pinckney had to say, and so later on, Pinckney is able to massage history a little bit, as it were, and come up with this elaborate plan that he supposedly presented to the convention and the committee to the convention and discussed in the committee of the whole to kind of make himself, I think, somewhat look more involved, which is unfortunate because Charles Pinckney is very involved in the convention. He's a leader. He's got a lot to say and a lot to do, and we're going to get into a lot of that as we move downstream here. But for some reason, he felt the need to label something the Pinckney plan and put it in there. What you really need to grasp is that there are really two competing plans. The New Jersey plan, which is a single legislature. It's a single organization, one state, one vote. It's identical to the Articles of Confederation. And the Virginia plan, which moves to a more national government based on population of regions and states, as opposed to one state, one vote. It's these two plans that will be argued, debated, discussed, and developed and massaged and eventually end up in compromise, all under the leadership of Nathaniel Gorham, not George Washington. And I think that's an important consideration to keep in mind. By the time George Washington reascends the dais to start voting on individual elements of the plan, most of this will have already been worked out in the Committee of the Whole. And so when you ask yourself, who is it that really oversaw the development of the compromise and the two plans and the development of our three-branch government, you can raise a toast to Nathaniel Gorham, who, although he will die in poverty and in disgrace and in failure, is the man who sat on the dais, the same chair where George Washington sat, while these concepts and ideas were hammered out and ironed out this week in Philadelphia in 1787.